that there's Kleenex. I get weepy. Hi, Marcy. I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be alive and sober today. My sobriety date is November 13th, 1994. I got a couple little disclaimers. I don't tend to talk in a straight line, more of like a big, huge, giant circle, and then it's like, oh, I see how she connected that dot. So usually I connected dots, but not always. So be patient. All right, so I was born in the Chicago area. And half my family is Orthodox Jewish, and half my family is Roman Catholic, and I was raised guilty. I am not kidding. And when I was a very outgoing young child, I was very adventurous. My parents would regularly have to chase me down, so I just walk out the front door, whether we were at home or relatives or whatnot, and I just go exploring. And then there was a childhood trauma, and I wouldn't like that anymore. I was very scared all the time. I also had the attention span of a small squirrel. That has not changed. So I feel very sorry for my mother. When I was about 7, 8 years old, we moved from the Chicago area to Iowa City, Iowa, because it is a family tradition to move to opposing Big Ten schools. My father went to Illinois. My mother went to Purdue. We moved to where the University of Iowa is. And, oh, look, I'm here. I lived in a very diverse little pod where we lived on a corner lot, and the people who on next door on one side was a nice Hindu family, and the people on the other side of us was a nice Buddhist family, and there was a lovely Palestinian Muslim family across the street from the driveway, but there were some people who in the neighborhood who did not like any of us, There were basically a couple little neo-Nazi children in the neighborhood who learned this behavior from their grown-ups. And I used to come home very black and blue and bloody and beaten because I did not follow the teachings of Christ. So Christians frightened me. I'm a little nervous. I don't speak very often. When I was very first asked to speak, when I was young in sobriety, my sponsor was standing right there, and she went, "No, she's skittish. She'll like faint or puke or something. She's not ready for that. I'll tell you when." So I never spoke until I had like 6 years sober or something. I'm still a little nervous about it. So, my father is a Vietnam vet with post-traumatic stress, and so my household was rather unpredictable. You could do something one day, and that's fabulous, and you do the same thing the next day, and you never knew what kind of consequences were coming. My parents fought constantly. I was that child praying for divorce. Please let them stop. Please let them stop. My friend's folks were getting divorced, and they were all upset. I'm like, what are you talking about? You got a credit card, and you're 13, and they don't fight anymore. But I never felt comfortable with who I was, and I used to make up a lot of stories and trying to be somebody else. And that didn't work very well at places like summer camp, where you're all in a little pod of kids, and you tell like six people one story, and then you turn around and tell six other people a completely different story, and yeah, they eventually find that stuff out. But I was just basically not a happy camper. I was never comfortable in my own skin. I also was sick. I remember I was a teenager. I don't remember what age I started drinking. It's one of the little benefits of Jewish. We have holidays where we drink, and it's appropriate to give the children a little glass of wine. So I don't know what age I started drinking. I do know what age I started doing other substances. And I do know that my behavior became inappropriate very quickly. It is generally frowned upon at one bat mitzvah at 13 years old to steal a bottle of champagne from the kitchen and go off with some other kid and get and drink the whole thing and show back up at the reception drunk. This is not an okay thing. My mother was not a happy camper. And I'm sure she was not the only one who was not a happy camper. But I tend to believe that my first actual addiction and trying to make myself feel better that I regularly partook in was food. And I ate and ate and ate until I was like the blueberry girl and you could roll me down the hallway. And anybody who says, how can you have an addiction to food? I had a conversation with somebody once about that, and this person, their drug of choice was marijuana. I said, take one hit off of one joint three times a day and leave it around the rest of the time. And they're like, oh, crap! So, you know, it is. And I'll admit, I have found comfort in that again. That's because after my second, I don't need a man, I have cake. anyway, so, it's, I don't know, in junior high, I started purging as well as binging, and I started doing mass quantities of exercise, and I started smoking, and I started hanging around people who drank a lot, and I started taking a thermos of alcohol with me to school. Boysenberry Kamikaze. And I started hanging around a lot of people who did drugs, and you know, I started getting comfortable being around these people as long as they did stuff worse than me, you know, because then I could be the normie one, you know. And I think I was about 16 years old the first time I partake in a green leafy vegetative substance. Underneath a bridge, and I fell in love with it instantly, and it wasn't too long later that I started a business and got into wholesaling. I was sick a lot. And we couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. I was constantly in the doctor's office, and I was getting blood drawn every couple of weeks, and I was in a state of exhaustion, not that drinking, smoking, not eating, throwing up had anything to do with that. It turned out I was actually sick, and my father had this thing where whenever I would get sick or injured, he'd go, you know, Mars, there's a difference between pain and injury. Well, remarkably, except for the time I got mono, every time he said this, because this sentence was followed by a 20-minute lecture, I seemed to get something surgically removed from my body. And it started family fights where my mother, I would say, you know, my father would say that, Dad, don't say that, from my mother. I was sick. I had a tumor inside my front cleaning, you know, glands on the inside of your neck, like right there that swell up when you get sick. Yeah, I got a hole there now. And it was about the size of my fist. And apparently had been growing there for a very, very long time. And they figured if they didn't get it out really quick, it was going to burst, and I was going to go, the gland would burst, and I would go into shock, and I would die. But they honestly didn't think that, with my health, that I was going to be able to survive. And so we put me on the list. I'm just grateful for the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, man. These people saved my life. I went and had some experimental surgery involving lasers. And I did not expect to wake up. And I did wake up. And the right side of my face was temporarily paralyzed. And so I had a little bruising, like when you have a stroke. And this is very traumatic when you're 16 years old. You're a 16-year-old girl. This is scary. And I had a scar about a quarter inch thick, goes from about the middle of my throat up along my ears. So I came out of there with no self-esteem. However, I was given a straight drip of morphine for 4 straight days. I was so high, I could not sit up by myself. And I didn't care. I didn't care what I looked like. I didn't care about the scar. I didn't care about anything. My lovely juvenile delinquent friends would come and steal me off the floor and pop me in a wheelchair and take me outside and try to reteach me how to smoke. Yeah, we're waiting for pathology to find out what's growing in me. Let's see if we can teach her how to inhale fast enough so it wouldn't go out the other side of my mouth. It took some work, but we did it. I relearned. You know, that would have been the time to quit. And I'm lucky that some of them had more thought than others. I guess a couple of my friends had decided to make a rig to rig up a bottle of vodka to my ID, and somebody decided that was a bad idea. And I am grateful for whoever decided it was a bad idea. But I came out of that hospital just chasing that feeling that I had when I was in it. After about a week or so, my parents decided it was time for me to go to school. I was afraid of going to school because I did not want to get the ridicule of the scar and the droopy face and the whatnot, and it was apparently not the right day to do that. My father grabbed me by the throat and slammed me up against the wall. And I could see myself in the mirror turning blue. And when he released his grip, I split. I ran away from home. And there was this girl I used to hang out with. Her mom worked at McDonald's. My parents looked like they had a lot of money because at one point in time they did, and so they would go and buy nice cars and nice stuff, and they were just basically running up credit because they didn't want anybody to know that they no longer had money because my father really had not been working for multiple years, and my mother was, you know, working on data entry type of salary. I went over to this girl's apartment, and her dad was a grad student, and her mom went to McDonald's, and she thought I was a whiny, spoiled brat. And she said, "Don't worry, I know exactly where to take you. I know where to take you, where you will be taken care of." And she took me to this guy's house, and I got high, and I got drunk, and I don't know what he gave me, but I could not get up off the floor. And I was basically told that there was a price for staying at his apartment. I was welcome to get up and leave if I was not willing to give up my virginity. And obviously I was not able to give up and leave. He did allow me to call my parents. My mother was furious that I left and told me to stay out there. And so that is how I lost my virginity. And I found myself on the streets because I couldn't go home. I left the house with nothing. I don't even think I had my purse. And I found myself in a situation where I was doing things, I was getting high all the time, but I wasn't doing things that nobody wants to do to get high. I was getting high because I was doing things nobody wants to do in order to live. And I eventually ran into a friend of mine from school who took me to his parents' house, and they got me into a shelter. And they got me into a youth organization and got me into counseling. And they basically planted the seed of willingness to take suggestions. And so I really consider that seed that was planted by those wonderful people that allowed me to eventually end up in here. So we'll fast forward a little bit. I eventually graduate high school with a really crappy grade point average because I had missed so much school from being sick that I was going to have to take another year. Screw that. So I finished school. I markedly did not get high at school. I would drink, but I wouldn't get high because the people I saw get in trouble were the ones that smelled funny. And I wasn't willing to do that. And I couldn't seem to hold a job down because I was willing to get high before work. I eventually got pregnant. And I had a baby. And I got out of business. Because back then, when you turned 18 and they found out that you were doing something illegal, you went to, before that you went to baby jail. You didn't go to real jail when you were a teenager. And I didn't want to risk real jail. And then I quit doing things that you bought on the street because I didn't want to risk the Department of Human Services either with my kid. Alcohol was a regular state of attendance. I always had a couple of glasses of wine. Now, mind you, I don't know how much I actually drank because I never get the glass all the way empty. And so I never really counted because, empty, one, fill it, empty, two, fill it. If it never got all the way empty, it was a glass. Maybe two. Given things like car accidents, I was a passenger, and injuries and the thing I had in my neck. I had had a second surgery in 1989 as well, for the same thing. It was very easy for me to go to the doctors and go, I hurt. And, here, I have this prescription. Actually, my doctor wouldn't do that, but my doctor wasn't in on Fridays, and the doctor who wasn't on Fridays did do that, so I got hurt a lot on Friday. And my poor mother, she never believed I was an alcoholic. She believed I was a hypochondriac because she was, they didn't have prescription drug care, but she paid for all these pills. And I was on her insurance plan, so she was getting the bills. I don't think she figured out that I had alcoholism until I was 8 years sober. I was in college, and I wasn't doing very well in college. I kept changing my major. I didn't finish all my core courses, though. I was in college from 1988 to 1994, and I never got my degree. I had like 8 or 9 majors. Pre-law, math. I almost went anthropology, social work, psychology, art. And I was constantly trying to not just please myself, but please my family. And sometimes I would go and do very, very well in school. It mostly was whether or not I actually went to class. Morning classes didn't work very well because that meant I had to, I don't know, get up and attend. But, okay, so this is not working very well. Let's change my major. That'll do it. And, there was this, I wasn't a happy camper, but there had not been a crisis yet. I had not killed anybody. I had not gotten arrested for drunk driving. No, knock on wood, no major bad had happened. I was just still not happy in my own skin, and stuff was not working. And I had English class with a guy who was in the program, and he was very, very open about Alcoholics Anonymous, and would talk about what life used to be like, what happened, and what was like now. And one day, I've been depressed for days. I was isolating. I was just not a happy camper, and my first instinct, I went to the refrigerator to drown my sorrows in that and purge it all back up, but there was this part of me that went, wait, no, I can't do that. I went to the liquor cabinet. Now, my grandfather was a chronic alcoholic, so I recognized that immediately. I don't want to go that direction. I went to the medicine cabinet and saw that I had like over 20 bottles of pills in there, and I didn't know what all of them were, and I called him up, and he brought over a girl I went to high school that I distinctly remembered saying when she was like 15 years old, I heard your parents sent you to treatment, man, that sucks. And so she's over at my house with this guy I went to college with, 12-stepping me into this program, and they recommended that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to my first meeting, and it was like a 5:30 meeting on a Friday at a clubhouse called Melrose at 511 Melrose Avenue in Iowa City. And the only thing I remember from that meeting was saying something along the lines of, I think I might be going towards possibly becoming having a drinking problem, and that there was some old guy, there seems to always be some old guy, when I came around at his turn saying, you know, normal people don't go to an AA meeting on a Friday night. It's not like, hey honey, what are you doing tonight? Let's go to the movies, let's go out to dinner, I know, let's go to an AA meeting. If you're here, you might want to stay here. And that's the only thing I remember from my first meeting with AA. I stuck around because the second half of the first steps, that our lives become unmanageable, I knew my life was unmanageable. My life started unmanageable. And I didn't understand the concept of powerlessness. And I struggled, but I stuck around. You know, they told me, keep coming back, and I did. I really didn't know what else to do. It's not like we refer out. We get a lot of referrals in, doctors, clergy, psychiatrists, but we don't refer out. I stuck around and I struggled and I went through I don't know how many sponsors, because I would go and say, will you be my sponsor? And they go, yeah, sure. And then I like never talked to them again. And a week later, will you be my sponsor? And so there wasn't a lot of step work involved. For a long time, I eventually did get a sponsor that I actually worked with, and I don't know if you didn't realize that I never did the first step, but I didn't realize I never did the first step either. And I struggled with the second step, and I remember being in a meeting and crying because I was just still miserable. And somebody said to pray for the willingness to be willing. And I was, my kid was about 2 or 3, and I had this friend, she would babysit for me to go to my home group on Thursday nights at the Oakdale Correctional Institution. They had a little prison campus, and that was not behind bars. And it was actually medical school campus that was nowhere near anything else except the prison. And I would go there, and a friend of mine lived near there, and I would drop my kid off to babysit, and she had this hobby of clipping out those really weird articles, like from Inquirer, you know, Elvis is an alien type of thing, and putting it on a refrigerator, and then when she found one that was weirder than the one that was already on the refrigerator, it would be replaced, and the one on the fridge would go in a scrapbook. And one day, in my struggle with the second step, because I really wasn't thrilled with the way I grew up, I was being raised guilty, and I wasn't quite sure what to do. She put this thing on the refrigerator, and it was the power of the blue dot. And this is an official blue dot. And if you rub this blue dot and wish upon it, your wish will come true. Well, for a lack of anything better, I would, on Thursday, rub this blue dot and say the prayer before and after that meeting when I dropped off and picked up my kid. And it stayed. She eventually just, you know, that never got scrapbooked. That was my dot, and it lived on her fridge. And, you know, I eventually came to a point where I realized that the clergy was not my higher power, and the behavior of the congregation was not my higher power, and that I do not have to define what my higher power was. I just have to know that it's not me. And after a while, I kind of forgot about the dot. Until one day. I was at this meeting. I was getting a mess. I'm at this meeting at Melrose, and I got the last seat at the table, and there's this kid across from me that I had never met before. I go to introduce myself. The meeting starts, and the topic is the second and third step. It starts going around, and it goes around the other way. So it goes to this kid first. He looks at me, and he goes, you know, so he's like right across from me. He's looking straight at me. He's like, you know, I was having a really hard time with this whole second step until my sponsor told me about this crazy-ass bitch with a blue dot. And everybody loses it because they know who she is. And then he's looking straight at her. And I was not very spiritually healthy at the time, so I owe this kid a man should I ever see him again, because when it gets around to me, I said, hi, I'm the crazy ass bitch with the blue dot. And she goes, I didn't mean to do it, I'm sorry. But, you know, he did say that it helped him realize that it really could be anything. And because he couldn't identify with it. It can be a doorknob. It can be a tree. It can be, I don't know. There was something about this whole blue dot thing that worked for him. Okay. Actually, time before last I spoke, I was asked to I get asked to be on second step panels at conferences, and the last time I spoke on a second step panel at a conference, this guy from Chicago comes up after me and goes, oh my God, you're real! Thanks, kid. And apparently that story lives in Chicago. You know, I struggled. I did a lot of waltzing. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, don't want to do 4. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, don't want to do 4. And I didn't do 4. And I struggled with 3. And because I never really did one. And I got my year and I felt like I graduated. And I started feeling uncomfortable at meetings because I started to feel like I'm not supposed to feel like this anymore. I have time. Yeah, right. And so I quit talking in meetings. And one day my sponsors just said, you know what, I don't know what else I can do to help you. But she only ever gave me one assignment, and that was like to read page 63. Every day, selfishness, self-centeredness, that which we think is the root of our trouble. She had me read the same paragraphs, and I didn't get why she had me read that until I had like 8 years sober. And one day I started thinking, you know, because I first came in, I was 22 years old. You know, I thought, well, maybe I was just young. Maybe it was just teenage angst and college and whatnot. Why can't I just have one drink? And I regularly thought about this for several months, and it's 22 months sober. I decided I'm going to try this. I'm going to have one drink. It was a Friday, so of course I went to the doctor first because it was Friday. And my son was at my folks' house, and I went out to have one drink, and it was the first time that I drank that I literally could not stop, and I was conscious that I could not stop. If I could not stop beforehand, I never realized that I could not stop. The second I had the one, I wanted two. The second I had two, I wanted three. And I had told people what my intentions were. None of them were in the room. They were like my normie friends. They all knew. But none of these guys knew. The friend that went with me, she's like, you know what? I think it's time to go home. You've had three. I'll take you home. And I get in the car, and I'm like anti-drinking and driving. I was like the designated driver in frickin' high school. I drink like a fish because I'm anti-drinking and driving. Went to a lot of funerals my high school career. And so we were very adamant about that. And I did. I got in that car. And that was a Friday, and I woke up on Sunday. I woke up in detox. And I'm grateful that I had never been to detox here. Like detox there. I woke up at detox in Mecca. And I woke up at 5:33 in the morning. Oh, thank God, it's just a dream. I realized I'm in a hospital gown and hospital robe and hospital slippers, and I walk out of this room, and there's this guy that I had the hugest crush on, who had like 3 years sobriety, taking my picture with a Polaroid and taking my blood pressure. And I vaguely remembered a strip search being involved at some point in time prior to that. I asked if I could have a cigarette, and I was given my cigarettes and my lighter and my names on them, my masking tape, and I was escorted to a little room with two folding chairs, a standing ashtray, and a two-way mirror. And my first thought was, this is not my life. This is an ABC after school special, because the writing is just not that good. And my second thought was, if I can just stay here, I'll get it together and everything will be okay. And my third thought was, if I can just find my way out of here, I can go get myself something, pull myself together, and everything, it'll be okay. And that's when I really, really understood the first step. That's when I really understood powerlessness. And that's when I really first turned things over to the higher power. It was like 1, 2, 3, right there, bam. And it was like I suddenly got this headache from this blinding light of reality, from my head being pulled out of my tuchus, and it's popping noise, you know. I didn't know what day it was. I didn't know where my kid was. I didn't know where anything. I reluctantly checked out of there because they wouldn't let me use the phone because it was a weekend, and they wouldn't let me call a counselor. And so I did. I checked out, and it turned out that my boyfriend, who had previously been going, I don't understand why hanging out with sick people is going to make you better, found me wasted and called up the phone list I had next to the phone and got people to come over, and they're the ones who took me in, and they took care of my kids so that I would not lose custody. And Monday morning, I had called and said I checked myself out, and I want to come into treatment. And but I had all this kind of other crap going on. Something happened that weekend. I don't know what. I don't know what I took. I don't know what I did. But I was suddenly having like 12, 15 panic attacks a day for no reason whatsoever. The Jewish American princess suddenly could not handle shopping because the noise was just too intense. And I would get dizzy and disoriented, and then I couldn't find my way out of the store, and I would panic. And it turned out that I fried a few brain cells, and I fried out the part of my brain. I just found this out from the neurosurgeon just right now. What actually happened? Like a month ago. Your ears, you hear things twice, and your auditory processing center merges them into one. It's, blends them all, mixes it, and mine doesn't do that anymore. So I like start with an automatic echo. And when I get someplace with echoes, it's just instant dizzy. Put visual stimulus on top of that. I can't deal with it. Grocery store is bad. Walmart is oh hell no. And I've also fried my fight or flight system. You come across a bear in the woods and you're gonna try and kill it or you're gonna run away. Mine is always on, all the time. It won't shut off. And I've tried a few other brain cells too. I was in the process of changing my major from psychology to astrophysics because physics was easy. And I had previously been a math major, and I suddenly had difficulty with basic math. And I am now, calculator is now my friend. And so the consequences that I never had, I got. And they are permanent. And I went and previously I had this sponsee who just, she had gone and she just went on this spiritual path and she just took off like a freaking rocket. And eventually she outgrew me very, very quickly, and I had asked her, when I came back, I had asked her to be my sponsor. And we did 4 steps. And we did 5 steps. And my family was not too thrilled with my behavior. And interestingly enough, I had, you know how they tell you in your first year you don't make any major changes? You don't have a year yet. In your first year, you don't make any major changes. I had, my family lived really close, and my father's office was like a mile from my house, and I'm the sick one who was on a student on welfare and is now disabled. We have to take care of her, but we're not very healthy, and this is not working out well. I'm going to go and get the lie to her landlord to find out, get the key and start digging through her stuff, kind of thing. I had my sponsor and my doctor and my therapist and the lady at treatment and my best friend. I think I mentioned the doctor, all going, you need to move away from from these people. Do not wait till you have a year. We're not sure if you'll make it that long. I'm like, okay then. I had previously gone on a rock climbing trip at Devil's Lake, and for phys ed credit, it was my first spiritual experience. It was like me, God, a rope, and a rock. Well, that and the guy holding the rope, but I really wasn't paying attention to him at the time. It was just me, God, a rope, and a rock. And, you know, it's pretty up here. You guys have trees. And, you know, I was lush and green and had a hill. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to Wisconsin. And so for a couple of months, I went, and every weekend I would put my kid in a car, and I would go and cross the border, look at the odometer, go, not far enough, go to the next town, look at the odometer, not far enough, go to the next. You know, and I land up here and upheld the tradition of moving to opposing Big Ten schools. Well, yeah, I had, I started coming here. I moved up here. It was a struggle to actually get up here. The second I told my parents I was thinking of leaving, they sold my car. I said, well, here's what I called. I'm like, hey, Dad, did you borrow my car? No, I sold it. You can't sell my car. My poor kid ended up with three trips to the emergency room within like the next 2 weeks because there was this funky sidewalk like two houses down from me, and every time going one way he was fine, going the other way he would trip and fall and crack his chin open. And after three trips to the emergency room, boom. So I moved up here and I found fellowship up here, and I learned to work the steps up here, and I didn't always do that very well. You know, I sometimes had learning lessons. You know, they say half measures avail us nothing. I think half measures avail us something. I think half measures avail us pain and suffering and loneliness and a lot of crap. And I did some of that in sobriety. I had some periods of time where I wouldn't leave my house or talk to anybody for days or weeks at a time. And a couple years ago, she gave me that 10-minute warning thing. So I'm like, suddenly going from like 9 months over here, like started 16. Big gap. A couple years back, I had a third surgery. I had forgotten why I left Iowa and moved back. When the doctor said, you know what, I'm good, but I'm not that good. Is there any way you can go back to Iowa? I'm like, okay. And I was there for a year and realized, oh, that's right. All right, next time I'll commute for surgery. That's fine. I moved back here, and about 6 months after my surgery, I started having excruciating pain. I had gotten nerve damage, and my face was just totally pissed. And of course, the first thing the doctors wanted to give me were narcotics. And you know, I did. I take them on my bike. They don't do anything but make me stupid. And I had to learn how to deal with chronic pain. I am on medication, but nothing with any street value. Go dig in my purse, you're going to go, really? I don't want that. And I learned how to meditate. But I learned how to be very, very quiet. And I learned how to be by myself. Because I had forgotten that I can do things like call and ask for me to be at my house. And I ended up being very, very lonely. And one day, I went to Wikipot 2 years ago. If you have not registered, please register. We need to buy a plane ticket for the speaker. And I went to WikiPot, and on Sunday morning, I broke down crying. Because I felt alone. And I dove back into the steps, and I dove back into the fellowship. And, you know, I have to say that I hear a lot of times it being misquoted that I would not, that I see it a lot of times as being misquoted that, great, now my brain doesn't want to work. Sometimes the gears just go, and, that my worst day in here is better than my best day out here, there. And I think that gives a really bad message, because it's actually, I wouldn't trade my worst day in here for my best day out there. Because I had some good times out there, and I've had some crappy times in here. You know, when my mom died, I did not show up for the meeting going, happy, joyous, and free. I'm sorry, sometimes stuff happens and it sucks. I would not make that trade. And I'm grateful to say today that I have the gifts that the steps have given me. And that fellowship has given me. And that all you guys have given me. And so I'll pass. Thanks.
Here, if anybody would care to comment.